Hello, listeners, and welcome to the NK News Podcast. It is the morning of Saturday, October the 3rd here in Seoul, but in California, it is Friday, October 2nd. And my special guest today, joining me from the United States via Skype, is Secretary William Perry, who served as United States Secretary of Defense from February 3rd, 1994 to January 23rd, 1997 under President Bill Clinton during a time of particularly tumultuous relations with North Korea. Before that, he also served as Deputy Secretary of Defense in 1993-94 and Under Secretary of Defense for Research and Engineering in the 1970s and 80s. Welcome on the show, Secretary Perry, and thank you for joining me.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Let me start off with a book that you've probably read because you appear in it quite a bit. That's Don Oberdorfer and Robert Carlin's book, The Two Koreas. In that book, you are described as perhaps the most influential policymaker in the nuclear crisis of 1994. Would you agree with that description?
Well, I certainly was deeply involved in it. I'm not the best person to judge whether I was the most influential.
Yes, yeah, so I wanted to start off by talking a little bit about that crisis. In early 1994, you warned that the United States would not permit the development of an arsenal of nuclear weapons. You said that war was not imminent, but you indicated that you'd ordered military preparations for a possible conflict. How close did things get to a conflict in 1994?
At the time, I was very concerned about it. I thought it was a real possibility, and we were preparing for it. In retrospect, I think we were never very close to it. To a certain extent, what seemed to us to be a great danger at the time, to a certain extent, was North Korea talking a tougher game than they were really intending to play. But at the time, we took it seriously.
Would a surgical strike on the plutonium production reactor have worked, do you think?
I can tell you what I think thought at the time and what I still think now, which is it certainly would have been very effective. We could have shut down that reactor without causing any incidental damage. We had precision cruise missiles that could do that, and we were prepared to do that rather than let them North Korea go ahead with its nuclear program. That, I think, is quite correct. But at the time, and still today, I believe that the biggest danger was not in the strike itself, but in the fact that the strike might make North Korea obliged to respond militarily, for no other reason, as a way of saving face. And I thought that the way they would probably do that was a military strike on South Korea, probably a limited one, but still a military strike on South Korea. And so the danger then was that they would do that and that would get out of control. That would escalate beyond the control either of the North Koreans or South Koreans or Americans. So that's what I was concerned about. I was concerned about the possibility of an attack on South Korea escalating into something big. Not that either side deliberately wanted a war, but that it could get out of control. I was going to say, the history of warfare is filled with incidents where wars are started, not because one side or the other wanted it, but because something happened, some minor thing happened that escalated and got out of control.
Right. Now, in the end, luckily, there was no preemptive strike. But now, the flip side of that is that North Korea has indeed developed an arsenal of nuclear weapons, something you said at the time that America would not permit. How did they get away with it?
My short answer to that is this happened during the George W. Bush administration. And the Bush administration also was determined not to let North Korea get a nuclear weapon. The Bush administration took its eye off the ball. It got distracted by the military operations in Iraq and just wasn't paying attention.
That makes sense. How did you first learn about former President Jimmy Carter's visit to Pyongyang to meet with Kim Il-sung?
Well, I knew he was going to do it because he talked to President Clinton, essentially getting President Clinton's permission to do so, to go over to North Korea. So I knew he was in North Korea. And then the feedback from that visit happened in the most dramatic way. We were in the White House with the meeting of President Clinton and his security advisors. And the purpose of the meeting was to discuss my proposal to send more troops to South Korea. Mm-hmm. We were concerned, as I told you before, that North Korea might conduct some sort of a military operation against South Korea. And we thought if that happened, it might possibly escalate. And therefore, we were very aware of the fact that the North Korean had large numbers of troops very close to Seoul, you know, within basically an hour's drive of Seoul. And so if any military operation started, we wanted to be prepared to stop it before it got to the city limits of Seoul. And I thought we did not have enough troops, American troops, in South Korea at the time in order to assure that would happen. So I was recommending to President Clinton that we send more troops over there to reinforce the South Koreans along the border, not because we were prepared to start a conflict, but in the event that North Korea started a conflict, we could stop them before they got to Seoul. So the purpose of that meeting was not really to discuss whether to do that. President Clinton and I had already agreed to do it. It was to discuss how many troops to send. And I had three options. As I remember, the numbers were 10,000, 20,000, or 30,000. And I was laying out the pros and cons of each of those three options, and then President Clinton was going to decide which of the three options to pick. That was the meeting that was going on. And in the middle of that meeting, an aide came in the room and told President Clinton that President Carter was on the phone and wanted to talk with him, calling from Pyongyang. That was how we first got to report on President Carter's meeting with Kim Il-sung.
Now, I recall reading that there was some ill feeling or some concern that President Carter had undermined or had done his own thing without the direction of President Clinton. In retrospect, was it the right thing to do?
Yes, I think it was. I think it gave Kim Il-sung a way of getting out of the crisis, a way he could save face and still get out of the crisis without any kind of military operation. So I think the result was good.
And then you were involved in the months after that in the negotiations and the signing of the agreed framework with North Korea. Could you tell us briefly about your role in that?
Well, first, let me say that the call was President Carter saying that Kim Il-sung was prepared to stop the work on the reactor. And President Carter wanted to tell President Clinton that, but Clinton wanted to go on with the meeting we were having.
Uh-huh.
And so he sent his National Security Advisor, Tony Lake, out to get that message. So Lake came back and interrupted our meeting, then told us about Carter's proposal. And that's when we all first heard about the proposal that he had made. So basically, the message from Kim Il-sung was that he was prepared to meet with an American representative to discuss stopping the work on the reactor. And President Clinton's response to that was that he was happy to have the meeting, send somebody to meet with Kim Il-sung, but he would only do that if Kim Il-sung agreed to stop work on the reactor while the discussions were going on.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a very wise decision on President Clinton's part. Otherwise, Kim Il-sung could have dragged on the meetings forever. So that was the outcome of that meeting. It was a good outcome, I think.
Yeah, and then on to your role in the working out of the agreed framework. What was that like?
Well, the agreed framework, of course, we had a representative go over to actually meet with the North Koreans on the agreed framework and negotiate the terms. And my role was basically being the military advisor.
Mm.
To our representative. That was Bob Gallucci who did that. And so I worked in support. I worked in support of Bob Gallucci while he was conducting his negotiations.
26 years later, why do you think the North Koreans signed the Geneva Agreed Framework? Was it an act of good faith that was then messed up by the U.S. Congress, as some people tirelessly propound, or did the North see the agreed framework as a means of buying time to build nuclear weapons capability? What do you think of that?
I can never be sure of that, but I believed at the time and still think quite likely that it was done in good faith. But the North Koreans, even when they're doing things in good faith, like to have fallback plans. And so even while they were doing that in more or less good faith, they were still looking at alternative ways of getting nuclear weapons if they ever needed one.
If you had the chance to go back, what, if anything, do you think the Clinton administration could or should have substantially done differently under the framework?
I think the agreed framework was a good agreement. I felt that at the time, and I still feel that. I think it served us very well. It did not stop the North Koreans from pursuing an alternative approach to getting nuclear weapons, which we found out toward the end of the 1990s that they had another program going. But it certainly slowed down the whole process and kept them from getting to nuclear weapon at that time.
One historical question that's always fascinated me is when Kim Il-sung decided that his country needed to have nuclear weapons. Now, some say that he came to this conclusion as early as 1953 after the destruction of North Korea by U.S. bombers. Others feel it was as late as the 1990s after the fall of the Soviet Union. And then you've got people who believe it was somewhere in between. Do you have a theory on this?
I believe it was when the Soviet Union fell, because up until then, he believed he had the protection of the Soviet Union. When the Soviet Union fell, he knew that he no longer had that protection. So he was all by himself then. And at that stage, he believed that the only way he could guarantee continued integrity of the North Korean government and the continued role of the Kim regime was having a nuclear weapon, which guaranteed, he felt, that the United States would never take military action against him to overthrow the regime. He believed, all of my contacts with North Koreans, I'm leaping a little bit ahead now, but all of my contacts with North Koreans convinced me that the overriding motivation for them to go to the extreme measures and the extreme expense they went to get that nuclear weapon, because they believed that the United States was prepared to and would overthrow the regime with military force, and that the only way they could, and that their military force was not capable of stopping that, the only way they could assure that would not happen was to get a nuclear deterrence. So to them, the nuclear weapon was a deterrence whose objective was to keep the regime in power.
Now, I want to talk very briefly about sanctions. Were you one of the first people in the U.S. government to suggest the idea of the United States proposing United Nations economic sanctions if North Korea did not allow international inspections of its nuclear facilities?
No, I supported that, but that was an initiative that came from our State Department. You know, they had some good, but they never accomplished what was hoped for them. But they did some good. They did some good. I have no objection to the sanctions we had.
They're much tighter now these days under the United Nations and also under unilateral sanctions. It's very difficult, for example, for humanitarian organizations to carry out projects in the North.
I think more generally that if we have the nuclear situation in North Korea stabilized, which I think it is now, that our objective ought to be to find a way of helping North Korea become a more normal nation so that sanctions would not be necessary and so that we're not concerned about a military conflict with North Korea. And I think that's possible to do that, but it takes much more political skills than we've ever been able to exert so far. And it takes a close working with South Korea on it, because the key to the making North Korea an ordinary normal nation again is an economic improvement. And that can only come, I think, through assistance from South Korea. And the best example I can think of that assistance was the joint program that they have in a small town in North Korea, right near the South Korean border.
The Kaesong Industrial Complex.
The Kaesong, yeah. The Kaesong, North Korea provides the land, the factory, and the labor. South Korea provides the equipment and the skill on how to run an operation. Together, they were producing high quality products at very attractive prices. The goal at the time was to make Kaesong a pilot program, and to build on that 10, 20, 30 times the capacity the Kaesong was doing. That would have gone a long way towards putting North Korea on a path to become a normal country, to trying to, in time, become a country with the same kind of economic capability that South Korea had.
Yeah. Now, the flip side of the idea of North Korea becoming a normal country with economic development is this idea of North Korea's collapse. And I want to turn briefly to that topic. The book, The Two Koreas, to quote from that once again, says that you popularized the metaphor of North Korea as a disabled airliner rapidly losing altitude and seeking a soft landing, meaning a gradual unification or accommodation with the South rather than a destructive crash. Here we are more than a quarter of a century later, and North Korea shows no sign either of crashing or of pursuing that soft landing with the South. How do you now reassess that assessment of North Korea and what it wanted back then?
I still think the soft landing approach was the result we should be aiming for, and that's what we were aiming for up until the end of the 1900s. That all changed when the Bush administration came in power in 2001, and they had a different goal. Their goal was to destabilize the regime so that the regime would collapse. And I have to say that if I thought that goal could be achieved, I might have supported that too. But I at the time believed they didn't have any way of making that happen. And I'll never be sure that they did not have such a way because, as I said before, they got instead distracted by Iraq and they didn't really put the full attention on what they're doing, dealing with North Korea. So we'll never know whether that strategy would have worked because they never really put a serious effort behind it.
Now, but even before George W. Bush was elected as president, in fact, just a few weeks after the signing of the agreed framework on October 21st, 1994, the U.S. had its midterm congressional elections on November 8th of that year. And the result was that the Republicans controlled both houses of Congress. Newt Gingrich was suddenly one of the most powerful men, and the Republicans were not very interested in the execution of the agreed framework or any kind of deal with North Korea. So that was, you know, at least 2 years before George Bush became president. Was that pretty much the end of the success of the agreed framework?
That contributed to the end of it. It put the United States in a position where it could barely support the agreements it had made under the agreed framework. I can remember back when I was still Secretary of Defense, the difficulty of getting the small amounts of resources I needed for Congress in order to carry out the agreed framework. So they, Republicans under Gingrich, did everything they could, I think, to defeat that. They were not successful, but they were successful in making it very hard to carry it out and only carrying it out in half measures. And those half measures are what gave North Korea an excuse, at least, for finding ways of getting out of it.
Now, we flash forward to the summer of 1998. You've now left the U.S. government. You are at Stanford. And things once more come to a head between the U.S. and North Korea, and you receive a phone call from President Clinton. Could you walk us through the context of that? What was the situation in mid-1998, and what did the president want from you, and how did you feel about it when you got that call?
Well, the first context was, as you were pointing out, that the Republicans in Congress were fighting the agreed framework until we were only able to carry it out in part, in a half-hearted measure. It was still alive, but it was on life support. The agreed framework wasn't functioning as fully and effectively as it ought to have been. That was one part of it. Another part of it was the North Koreans were beginning the testing of what they called satellites. And indeed, I'm willing to believe they were satellites, but in order to test a satellite, you have to fire a missile which has the same, which if a nuclear, which if a warhead is put on it, has the capability of an ICBM. Mm. So these tests were advertised in the United States as long-range missile tests or even ICBM tests, which said a couple of things. First of all, it suggested aggressive intentions. And secondly, if it were an ICBM they were testing, an ICBM makes no military sense with a high explosive warhead. It could only mean that they had thought they were going to have a nuclear warhead for that ICBM. And that to us was evidence that they had somehow kept the nuclear program going, that is, they had an alternative development program to develop fissile material for a nuclear weapon. So we believed they had found a way of evading the agreed framework just on the basis of those missile tests.
Yeah, and then what was it that President Clinton asked you to do, and how did you react?
He asked me to prepare a diplomatic, political approach to dealing with those problems, to resolving those problems, and then to go to Pyongyang and talk with the North Korean leadership and make our proposal and see if we can get an agreement. In other words, he asked me to work a political solution to that problem, and I agreed to do that. I did, but I told him, though, I would do it only if I could put together a three-person team. Beside myself, I wanted a comparable person from South Korea and a comparable person from Japan. Because I thought Japan had an important stake in this. And of course, South Korea had the most important stake in it. And I didn't want to be acting independently of those two countries. So both the Japanese prime minister and the South Korean the president agreed at President Clinton's request to put forward counterparts of myself. So we had a three-person team instead of just myself.
That was very important, wasn't it, to have that unity of purpose there?
I felt that at the time, and I think it worked out that way, exactly that way.
And ultimately, and I'll come to this a bit later on, but ultimately, when you went to Pyongyang to put forward the proposals, you actually managed to convince South Korea and Japan to let you speak directly on their behalf, didn't you?
Yes, I did. The South Korean president and the Japanese prime minister both told me that I was authorized to speak for them in my dealings with North Korea.
Now, that's quite remarkable in the course of human affairs and international politics. Was that difficult to persuade them to do that?
No, it would have been impossible at the beginning of this process, but it was not difficult at the end of it. I think they had become convinced that our three-person team had worked out a reasonable approach, and they became convinced they could trust me to represent their interests as well as our interests. So it took a couple of months to develop that trust and confidence, but we did it.
Now, I was interested to read that on the American side of that team, you recruited Ashton Carter, who had been one of your assistants at the Pentagon. He'd been involved in military planning in 1994 for the possible preemptive strike, had he not?
Yes, he had. I had two deputies, American deputies. One of them was Ashton Carter, and the other was Wendy Sherman from the State Department, both of whom were very, very helpful.
Okay, so you worked together for several months with the South Korean and the Japanese to put together some ideas, and then on May 25th, 1999, you actually went yourself to Pyongyang to talk directly to Kang Seok-joo, the then first deputy foreign minister, and then later he became the vice premier of North Korea. He's since died. Tell us about the two tracks that you offered North Korea in those talks.
Well, the first track was sort of death and destruction. I didn't dwell on this, but I made clear that we were prepared to take strong action and that we would be backed by both South Korea and Japan if we decided to do that. But to be clear, that was not really an important part of the discussion, because the positive part of the discussion got traction right away. And so while the negative track was always there, and I made it clear from the beginning it was there, we never really discussed that because we were getting so much traction on developing a way of dealing with the positive track. The meetings were very positive and very productive, I think.
You read out a statement sort of as a preamble before the two tracks, laying out the fraught or difficult history between the United States and North Korea and hoping for better things to try to sort of lay the groundwork, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
And did that seem to get their interest? I mean, what did Kang say to you? How did he respond?
I don't remember the specifics of that first day so much, except the very strong impression, which is what I was really looking for, that they were ready for serious talks and they were looking for a positive outcome. And that's the main thing I got out of that first day meeting. And then from there on, we were working out details of how to implement a positive response, what it should consist of, and how to implement it.
Now, did Kang Seok-joo seem to you to be empowered as a negotiator? To make decisions?
In a certain sense, yes. And let me explain what that sense was.
Yeah, please.
We would have detailed discussions all day and end up with a set of decisions to be made, really. And then he would go, and quite obviously, to meeting with the supreme leader. By that time, it was Kim Jong-il. And then he came back the next day, able to talk with authority on issues that he had only been able to work around the day before that. Mm. So every night, every day we would talk. Every evening, he would huddle with Kim Jong-il. And then the next morning, he came back with agreements and or counter proposals. So we were talking virtually with Kim Jong-il, but directly with Kim Seok-joo.
And now, you also met with a military leader, didn't you, in a separate meeting? How did that meeting go?
It went very well after kind of a rocky beginning. And the rocky beginning was that he came into the room, shook hands. I should preface this by saying that he was not on the agenda originally. And when I looked at the agenda, I told the North Korean president, who was sort of the titular head of the North Korea, that this agenda was unsatisfactory to me, that I had been a Secretary of Defense in the United States, and I certainly wanted to talk with some military people while I was there. And the very next morning, before I met with anybody else, in walks this general. And the first thing he said to me was, "This meeting is not my idea. I was directed to meet with you." He said, "I don't think we should even be discussing giving up our nuclear capability."
Mm.
And so I said, "Why is the nuclear capability so important to you?" And he said, "To deter aggression, to deter a military attack on our country." I said, "By whom? A military attack by whom?" And he looked at me and pointed his finger at me. He said, "By you, by America." And then he said something to the effect of, assuming now that they had the weapons, the nuclear weapons, he said, "If you attack us militarily, you will find nuclear weapons landing in your country. This is basically a crude statement of what nuclear deterrence means. That was my meeting with the general. I should also say later on in that meeting, while we were sitting at the table and talking with him, the deputy foreign minister interjected a statement. And the general looked at him and said something to the effect that, "You be quiet. This is my meeting." And then he turned to me and said, "You don't have to pay any attention to what these white collars are saying."
Did that give you the impression that there was a conflict or disagreement within the North Korean ruling elite?
Yes. Yes. More generally, I would say this, that the foreign ministry and the office of the president were very much in favor of coming to some sort of an agreement. They seemed to be quite willing to give up the nuclear weapon if they could get a good enough return for them. Mm. The general was not. And he was angry because his views weren't being seriously considered. He was in danger of being overridden. And he wasn't so much angry at me. He was angry with the foreign ministry people who were leading the charge to take this issue out of his hands. The foreign ministry's feeling was if they could get a good enough agreement, they wouldn't need the nuclear weapons. His feeling was that no matter what kind of an agreement they got, it could not guarantee the integrity of the country. Only nuclear weapons could do that.
Did you ask in that on that trip to Pyongyang to have a meeting with Kim Jong-il, and did you think that you'd have that chance?
I did not ask for that meeting. I was quite clear to me that we were talking with Kim Jong-il every day, even though he wasn't in the meeting. There was no shortage. Everything we were told was coming directly from every agreement that they made was coming directly from Kim Jong-il. It would have been nice to have had a ceremonial meeting with. I would have liked to have done that, but it was not important to my goal.
Now, how did your visit to Pyongyang conclude? Was it clear to you at the time which of the two tracks you offered the North Koreans would choose?
Yes, it was. What wasn't clear was how quickly they would move and how fully they would respond. And in time, it developed they're going to be very slow in responding. But when they did respond, they responded with a full agreement.
When you flew out of Pyongyang, did you feel that you had succeeded in your mission?
I expressed some concern about that because it was clear that they were putting off the final action. Mm. And I would have thought they might want to act on it right away. And I expressed that view to my team, and all of my team said, "Oh, no. Now, this is a very successful meeting. We came to the agreements we wanted to come to." And my Korean speakers in the group said they were confident that this was a positive meeting, not only from the words that were said, but from the way they were said, that they put special interpretation on the way the Korean language was spoken when they were responding to our requests. Mm. They said they were done with great courtesy and great respect. Mm-hmm. And they contrasted that with all the other meetings they'd had with there, where that was not the case. I have no way of making a personal judgment of that, but that was the considered opinion of the Korean language experts that were in our group.
Now, afterwards, after you'd returned to the United States, negotiations went on in Berlin and in Geneva. These are the negotiations led by Wendy Sherman, is that correct?
Yes.
And they led to an agreement on a moratorium on missile testing by North Korea.
Yes.
Now, in March 1999, in an op-ed for the New York Times, James Baker criticized the negotiating strategy with North Korea as appeasement. And this was echoed by John Bolton in June 2011 in an interview with the Washington Post when he accused Wendy Sherman of being centrally involved in formulating a policy that was, quote, nothing less than appeasement. Now, I'd like to ask you, Secretary Perry, what is appeasement and what is not appeasement in your opinion?
I have a hard time answering that question because, first of all, I thought I at the time interpreted both their statements as being politically motivated statements, not serious statements. Mm. There was certainly no appeasement involved in our meetings with North Korea. We were offering them two alternatives, one of which was a positive way forward, and the other which would have involved military action by the United States. I don't know how anybody who was really understanding of what we were proposing would consider that appeasement. I had deep respect for Jim Baker. I worked with him on many other issues of great importance. And I believe either he was not fully informed about what the meetings had accomplished, or he was making a pure political statement, a partisan political statement, one or the other. I'm not sure which. This was done, I believe, during the upcoming upcoming elections in 2000, where George W. Bush was going to be. So I think it had to do with the we'd have to look at the dates and the timing of his remarks before. But my belief was this was done as part of a presidential political rhetoric.
Now, in the end, even though North Korea did hold a moratorium on missile testing from 1999 until 2005, ultimately, it developed missiles even better at than the technology that was available to them at the time. Do you look at that as a failure?
Yes, I do. I think that what happened in 2000, well, what happened in 2000, late 2000, is the North Koreans came back to Washington prepared to reach a final agreement on the proposal we made, and proposing that President Clinton and Kim Jong-il meet to sign that agreement. So that was a delayed success, but pretty much a complete success of what we proposed. But they waited too long. The meeting in Washington was in October of 2000, just a month before the election. Of course, if the election had turned out a different way, if President Gore had won, we would have followed through on it. But he didn't win. And President Bush, I thought, was going to follow through on it because Colin Powell, who was his named Secretary of State, had told me that he proposed to follow through on it, that he agreed with what we had done, and he was going to push it forward to final signing. That got upset, of course, and did not happen. But not because Colin Powell didn't want it done, and I don't think it was George W. Bush. I think it was Dick Cheney.
So it was Dick Cheney who pushed for a policy of ABC, anything but Clinton, on North Korea.
Yes, he did. And in particular, his policy on North Korea is that we will put pressure on them and cause the regime to collapse. That was the policy. As I said, I might have agreed to that policy if they had any way of making it happen. We'll never know if they had a way of making it happen because they took their eye off the ball and didn't follow up on it. And that was, of course, because of their deep involvement in Iraq.
Right. Now, we flash forward another 5 years to June 22nd, 2006, when George Bush was well and truly into his second term. And you and Ashton Carter co-wrote an op-ed for The Washington Post titled, "If Necessary, Strike and Destroy." Now, in order to set up the next question, I ask for your and the listeners' forbearance as I read a long quote from that op-ed piece. "Should the United States allow a country openly hostile to it and armed with nuclear weapons to perfect an intercontinental ballistic missile capable of delivering nuclear weapons to U.S. soil? We believe not. The Bush administration has unwisely ballyhooed the doctrine of preemption, which all previous presidents have sustained as an option rather than a dogma. It has applied the doctrine to Iraq, where the intelligence pointed to a threat from weapons of mass destruction that was much smaller than the risk of North Korea poses. But intervening before more mortal threats to U.S. security can develop is surely a prudent policy. Therefore, if North Korea persists in its launch preparations, the United States should immediately make clear its intention to strike and destroy the North Korean Taepodong missile before it can be launched. This could be accomplished, for example, by a cruise missile launched from a submarine carrying a high explosive warhead. The blast would be similar to the one that killed terrorist leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi in Iraq. But the effect on the Taepodong would be devastating. The multi-story, thin-skinned missile filled with high-energy fuel is itself explosive. The U.S. airstrike would puncture the missile and probably cause it to explode. The carefully engineered testbed for North Korea's nascent nuclear missile force would be destroyed, and its attempt to retrogress to Cold War threats thwarted. There would be no damage to North Korea outside the immediate vicinity of the missile gantry." And then, at the end of that piece, you both concluded, "This is a hard measure for President Bush to take. It undoubtedly carries risk. But the risk of continuing inaction in the face of North Korea's race to threaten this country would be greater. Creative diplomacy might have avoided the need to choose between these two unattractive alternatives. Indeed, in earlier years, the two of us were directly involved in negotiations with North Korea, coupled with military planning to prevent just such an outcome. We believe diplomacy might have precluded the current situation. But diplomacy has failed, and we cannot sit by and let this deadly threat mature. A successful Taepodong launch, unopposed by the United States, its intended victim, would only embolden North Korea even further. The result would be more nuclear warheads atop more and more missiles. How did you move from a position of democracy is the only way to one in which you believed that democracy had failed and you were advocating here for direct intervention?
I participated in that op-ed with great reluctance because, as you know from all of my previous actions, I believed that diplomacy was the way to solve this problem.
Yeah.
And I believe that we had a very good chance of solving it through diplomacy. The Bush administration walked away from that diplomacy deliberately and consciously. And therefore, they let this development, not only of the nuclear weapons, but of the impending ICBM development, they let that happen. I would say this wasn't so much a serious proposal as it was a rebuke for the Bush administration and a warning to the North Korean government, neither of which was very effective, I think. So in retrospect, I wish I hadn't written the op-ed because it did not accomplish the purpose I'd hoped for it, and instead left me in the position of seemingly representing preemptive strike, which I'm not in favor of.
In the end, the Bush administration didn't choose that option, and the Daepodong 2 missile test, as well as some others, went ahead on July 4th, U.S. time, and the Daepodong 2 missile failed in under 1 minute. I take it, given what you just said, that you're glad in retrospect that President Bush did not choose to intervene.
I never expected President Bush to intervene. What I expected was that this might, what I hoped, was this might be, have a chilling effect on the North Koreans and cause them to reconsider their plans. But it did not. It did not.
When Barack Obama became president, he chose to sort of carry on from where Bush left off rather than trying to reach back to where Clinton left off. Why do you think that was?
I don't know why. I was very disappointed in President Obama's action relative to North Korea. I supported many, many things that President Obama did, and I have a high regard for his presidency. But in this particular case, he dropped the ball, I think. He did not follow up on what he could have done with North Korea to try to get us back on a reasonable track. To be clear, what we were proposing to do back in 1999 and 2000 was to stop the North Korean nuclear program. By the time President Obama was elected, they already had a nuclear arsenal. Yeah. So that option wasn't really open anymore. So he couldn't have gone back to where we were before, but he could have tried to pick up some of the underlying methodology, which is applying better thought through diplomacy to dealing with North Korea.
Now, in late 2017, during the first year of the Trump administration, North Korea tested its Hwasong-14 and Hwasong-15 intercontinental ballistic missiles, which were created specifically to be able to threaten the U.S. mainland. These were tested with some degree of success. Despite President Trump's threats of fire and fury, no actual kinetic intervention was attempted to destroy those missiles before or at the point of launch. But now the two things that America said it would not permit North Korea to do, that is, one, develop a nuclear arsenal, and two, develop intercontinental ballistic missiles. Both of these things have happened. What should be the focus of U.S. policy with North Korea right now? Should it be full denuclearization and destruction of missiles, or?
We should have a policy which has some possibility of succeeding, and neither of those policies would succeed. So the policy I think we should have at this stage is recognize, we understand that they have a nuclear arsenal, understand that they have long-range missiles, understand they have the capability of attacking South Korea, Japan, and the United States with nuclear weapons, but also understand that they have no intention, no reason for doing that, that their nuclear weapons are there for deterrence. They're there to keep the regime in power. They're there to keep us from using military action to overthrow the regime. And since we don't plan to do that anyway now, they pose no great threat to us. So I do not believe that today North Korean nuclear weapons pose a threat to Japan, South Korea, or the United States. They are there for deterrence, and that we should understand that and not be alarmed by them. I would prefer they didn't have them, and I'm through considerable effort to try to keep them from getting them. But now that they have them, I'm prepared to look at ways of dealing with that reality and dealing with it in a thoughtful and conscious way. And that way, I think, is to say they have a nuclear arsenal. What we should be discussing with them now, I think, is ways of containing that arsenal and keeping it becoming worse than it is now. We could probably get an agreement, I think, for example, on no more testing. We could probably get an agreement on not building the arsenal any larger. Those things might be possible and then would be worth having. I do not think it is possible to get with them an agreement to dismantle their nuclear arsenal that would be worth anything, that they would really follow through on. So I don't think we should be pursuing diplomacy that has no chance of success, or that has a chance of deluding us into thinking it has a chance of success.
You just said that you don't think that there's a great threat from North Korea using its nuclear arsenal against other countries. Is there a separate threat of North Korea proliferating or selling technology to other countries or non-state actors?
I would be concerned about that, yes. And we should, I should have added before that an important policy, important American policy towards North Korea should be keeping that proliferation from happening and taking both positive and negative diplomatic approaches to keep that from happening.
Do you think we know, do you think America has an adequate understanding now of what Kim Jong-un really wants?
I think we can understand with great confidence that the number one thing he wants is to stay in power and to keep the Kim regime in power. That's what the objective of his grandfather, his father, and himself have consistently been. And if we don't understand that, we're never going to deal effectively with him in any of our diplomacy. If he achieves that, then a strong second objective is to strengthen the economy of North Korea. And understanding that and understanding the role we can play in a positive way to make that happen, we can play those two objectives off against each other, I think, in an effective way if we're clever.
Mm-hmm. Didn't Donald Trump try to do that? I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but didn't President Trump try to do that in Singapore when he sort of showed that video and talked about, here are the economic possibilities, you know, your country could be great, look at what could happen?
He did one half of that. He didn't do the other half. He was offering that in return for North Korea giving up the nuclear arsenal.
Right.
And that he was not going to get. So he was just wasting his time. He didn't understand enough about North Korea to understand that that was a hopeless objective.
Mm. What opportunities are both America and North Korea missing right now, in your opinion?
We're missing the opportunity to work together to make North Korea into a more normal country. If they had a reasonable economy and they felt there were no threats to overthrow the regime, they might be able to work to become sort of a small-scale version of South Korea, a smaller version of South Korea. And I think South Korea would be willing to help them achieve that objective. And it would take some enlightened diplomacy to understand that it's probably in our objective, and it's probably in the objective of South Korea, to have North Korea a more normal country with a functioning economy. There's no reason why North Korea has to be this pariah country that's causing continual consternation on the world political scene. But the key to that long-term is getting to be a normal country with a reasonable economic structure. And we could help them do that. And the motivation, and there could be self-interest in that, in the motivation in helping them do that. But we've never been able to get our political thinking wrapped around that idea. That's what we were headed for in my negotiations with them back 20 years ago. But then the payoff at the other end of it was actually North Korea giving up the idea of building a nuclear arsenal, and that would have been a pretty big payoff. Now we don't have any comparable payoff to put with it.
Were you hopeful during the 2018 Singapore summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un?
No, I was not. I favored the idea of the summit. I think the idea of Trump having the summit was a good idea if he had had a reasonable negotiating position when they went into it.
Mm.
He did not have a negotiating position that had any chance of success, and he didn't know enough about North Korea to understand that when he went into it. He thought all he had to do was charm Kim Jong-un, and he would get what he wanted. And that was just a complete misreading of the man and the country.
But as you point out, the direct leader-to-leader diplomacy, that was something that had been untried in 70 years, and so Donald Trump definitely broke some ground on that. Do you think that he has...
Right, I salute him for that. I mean, I commend him for that. I think that was a good idea. I just wish he had had a thoughtful diplomacy to follow up with that.
Do you think it makes it easier for future presidents to try to do the same thing, to meet with the leader with a better negotiating position?
If they have a sound idea of what they're going to say when they meet, what the objective, what they're going to accomplish, it's one thing to be friendly with another country, but if you have profound disagreements to begin with, profound misunderstandings to begin with, the goal ought to be to try to find a way of working around and solving those problems, not just being friendly with each other.
Mm. I should point out that just in the news this morning, there was a report on NK News that Kim Jong-un has apparently sent a message wishing good health to President Trump fighting the coronavirus right now. So the personal diplomacy continues, even though the nation-to-nation diplomacy is at a standstill.
That's good. I just wish we could do something constructive with the personal diplomacy.
Are you in touch with anyone on the Joe Biden campaign?
Yes.
If you were asked to give advice on North Korea, what advice would you give?
I would give no advice during the campaign, but if he were to be elected, I would be happy to give them advice on what to do in trying to reestablish constructive relations with North Korea. By constructive, I mean friendly in the sense that President Trump was trying to do, but also leading towards objectives which could make the security of both South Korea and the United States better.
Mm. Do you feel that the repeated breakdowns of negotiations between North Korea and the U.S. has led to such a lack of trust that it's irreparable, or can we pick up and try again?
It's certainly a long history of failures, but I don't think we can ever give up on an issue that important. We have to keep trying.
Mm. Very difficult question here. Do you think that any U.S. president could ever make a deal with North Korea that would hold and be maintained by both sides for longer than a single American election cycle?
maybe not. Maybe not. I would have said, if you'd asked me 10 years ago, I said probably yes. But we've had enough wild swings in American foreign policy positions that it's shaken my confidence in that answer.
Mm. Now, what are you doing these days, sir? You're retired. I believe, in your 10th decade, in your 90s. What are you up to? You're still active in the field, aren't you?
I'm still active. I'm still writing. I've written a couple of books. I consult with people on these issues, not people in the present administration because they don't ask me, but I do talk with the people who would be in a Biden administration if Biden were to be elected.
And you have a center named after you, I believe.
One of the things I tried to promote when I was Secretary of Defense was better cooperation and political dealings with our neighbors in Central and South America. I made first ever trips for Secretary of Defense to Mexico, 3 South American countries, some Central American countries, and inspired by the positive response I got from the leaders in those countries, I created something called the Institute of the Americas, where we got together the defense ministers of all of those American countries and formed a meeting which we had in Williamsburg, Virginia, back in 1996, I think it was. Turned out to be a very successful meeting. And after I left office, those countries got together and decided to hold that meeting every 2 years as a regular event. The next one was held in Argentina the year after I left office, and they invited me to attend as an honored guest, which I did. So that whole thing's been going on, and one of the offshoots from that is that there was an Institute of the Americas formed in the United States to follow up on those activities under the Defense Department. And a year or two after I left office, they renamed that the Perry Institute. So it was an honor that the work I did trying to bring together all of the American countries, South America, North America, Central America, to deal with defense issues of mutual interest among the countries.
Right. And you also talk a lot about the danger of nuclear weapons and the importance of disarmament. Is that right?
That's my major activity today, is trying to alert the world to the danger of nuclear weapons. I take the position that the possibility of a nuclear catastrophe today is actually greater than it was during the Cold War. And yet the public does not understand that, the government does not understand that, and therefore our policies do not reflect that danger, and they're not therefore doing things they could do to mitigate the dangers. And so the purpose of my writing and my books and my talks are twofold. First of all, is to alert American people and the political body that there is that danger, and secondly, to recommend actions that we can take to mitigate those dangers in various ways. One of the principal actions I recommend is to change the policy we now have of what's called presidential sole authority, which means the president and only by himself, without consulting with anybody without getting approval from anybody, can launch nuclear weapons, can start a nuclear war. And I think that's a very dangerous situation. I call attention to it. I also call attention to the danger of our policy of launching on warning, that is, on a warning of a missile attack. We're set a structure to and designed to launch our weapons before they land. And the probability, the problem with that is if the warning happens to be a false alarm, then we have accidentally started a nuclear war. So I point out those dangers and suggest things that can be done to mitigate those dangers.
That's very important work that you're doing, and I encourage our listeners, if they'd like to hear more, to check out the podcast that your granddaughter, Lisa Perry, makes called At the Brink, episode 7 of which came out recently, and it's a conversation with you, amongst others, also Philip Yoon and others, about North Korea specifically. That's At the Brink. And also the Sam Harris podcast, episode 210, The Logic of Doomsday, was I very much enjoyed a long conversation between you and Sam Harris back in July on the threat of nuclear war.
Yeah, he did a very good job on that, I thought.
He certainly did. I'd like to thank you very much for joining me on the show today, Secretary Perry. It's been wonderful talking to you and learning a bit more about what's brought us to where we are now in terms of North Korea.
I enjoyed talking with you. You're obviously very well informed on the subject, and so it led to an interesting and, I hope, constructive dialogue.